Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is SOD 2 of For the Record program number 541, titled Leaks, being recorded on February 12th of the year 2006. We're going to plunge right in and resume the discussion with what we were speaking about at the end of SOD 1. There have been a number of disclosures, and perhaps that term belongs in quotes, about various misdeeds and or mistakes by the Bush administration vis-a-vis either the invasion of Iraq or the war conduct of the war on terror. And one of the things that we were looking at is the fact that in point of fact, it appears that Watergate was the result of intelligence community subversion of Richard Nixon's presidency, because Nixon had run afoul of elements of the intelligence community in a number of different respects. Likewise, many of the damaging disclosures that are coming to light about the Bush administration are apparently deliberately being leaked by elements of the national security establishment, meaning the intelligence community, the military, and the State Department, also to a certain extent the British national security establishment. Those national security elements are very upset with George Bush, and it appears that some of these leaks are deliberate attempts at fighting back, that what we're really looking at is something of a civil war within the U.S. and to a certain extent the British national security establishment as well. The disclosures concerning the fact that George Bush had authorized the NSA to conduct warrantless wiretaps of American citizens, this has been a focal point and of a great deal of discussion, and there has been much righteous brow, beating of breasts and wringing of hands. And frankly, to anyone familiar with the facts of the matter, the simple truth is that the NSA and its British intelligence counterparts at the GCHQ have been conducting warrantless wiretapping for decades. Literally, the NSA has been doing this since its inception. It is quite literally standard operating procedure. It has been for decades. The U.S. performs the same function on behalf of the British. So why are we seeing this Casablanca-type Louis Renault discussion of, we're shocked to learn that there's gambling going on in this establishment? You're winning, sir. You know that famous scene from Casablanca. Well, in fact, warrantless wiretapping by the NSA is literally business as usual. And by the way, the NSA aren't the only people that do this. A report by the European Parliament about the Echelon program maintained by the NSA and the British intelligence at Menwith Hill revealed that, in fact, European countries have the same capability, Germany and, in all probability, Russia as well. So this is not something that comes as great news. What is significant about the public flap concerning NSA warrantless wiretapping is the fact that this is even coming to light at all, because not only is it standard operating procedure, it sure as bloody hell didn't begin with George Bush. Rather, these leaks, not only the NSA warrantless wiretapping, but the other leaks that we are going to look at, these leaks are part of a civil war within the national security establishment and attempts by the intelligence community to fight back against the Bush administration. There also, as we'll see later on this side, there also appears to be an attempt by some seriously guilty elements, people like Grover Norquist, at covering up their own complicity in the terrorism that has bedeviled the United States. We're going to return now to the book, The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, co-authored by the heroic John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, and we're going to resume with our discussion of the reciprocal spying programs conducted by British and American intelligence, and in the course of the remaining discussion about the NSA warrantless wiretapping, we're going to take a look at the genesis of this, which is anti-Jewish paranoia in the United States. Returning to Loftus and Aaron's account, according to a former special agent of the FBI, the you spy on mine, I'll spy on yours deal has been extended to the other Western partners, particularly Canada and Australia. The British, with the help of sophisticated NSA computers, can bug just about anyone, anywhere. The electronic search for subversives continues, particularly in the United States. The NSA conceded precisely that point when the U.S. Justice Department investigated its wiretapping of American protesters during the Vietnam War. The NSA assured the Justice Department that the information was acquired only incidentally as part of a British GCHQ collection program. The incidental, unquote, British exception has become the rule. As discussed later in this chapter, illegal electronic surveillance, particularly against American Jews, continued past the McCarthy era, all through the Cold War, and past the collapse of the Soviet Union. In modern times, commercial interests in the Middle East, rather than security considerations, have been the driving force behind the domestic bugging. Where oil is concerned, the British and American wiretappers use their anti-Jewish intelligence as an under-the-table bargaining chip to appease the Arabs. Publicly, our nations are allied with Israel. Privately, we give secret intelligence to Israel's enemies in time of war. As we discuss in Chapter 12 on the Liberty Incident, Congress does not have a clue how the British-American wiretap war works. For that matter, U.S. supervision of American wiretapping has been minimal. During the 1975 Senate Church Committee investigations, the NSA was forced to concede that, quote, there is not any statute that prohibits interception of domestic communications, unquote. In short, the wiretappers were outside the reach of any existing law. Technology had outstripped the legal protections of privacy. While insisting that its efforts were mainly directed at overseas communications, the NSA also admitted that it was, quote, technically possible, unquote, to monitor domestic conversations within the United States, quote, if some person with malintent desired to do so, unquote. Some person, like J. Edgar Hoover, for example. Hoover was one of the biggest customers of wiretap information from its inception. In fact, the FBI made no bones about its right to listen in to domestic conversations without a warrant. It wasn't until a 1975 court case that the FBI was finally told that they had no legal right to wiretap individuals or organizations without a warrant unless there was a proven agency relationship, unquote, with a foreign power. In fact, until the stricter 1975 standards, the FBI could wiretap or place surveillance on any Jew who gave money to any Jewish organization that supported Israel. Here is an example of the type of innocuous information that was forwarded to the FBI as a result of their obsessive surveillance of American Jews. Quote, Emma Lazarus Foundation of Jewish Women Clubs among larger donors contributing $500 during a fundraising dinner held by the Emergency Civil Liberties Committee on December 15, 1962 at the Americana Hotel, New York City, in celebration of the 171st anniversary of the Bill of Rights, unquote. Loftus and Ahrens go on to comment. Apparently, Jews who celebrated the Bill of Rights were considered potential, if not actual, subversives. That remains FBI policy to this day. The FBI refused to accept the restrictions from an adverse 1975 court ruling and leaked its view to the media in a 1977 memo. The FBI still defended its right to spy on persons who, quote, might be, unquote, supporters of a foreign power, or even anyone in the country who, quote, might, unquote, be influenced by a foreign power. In light of the trivial intelligence haul from most of the surveillance, it was little wonder that over the years, Hoover had gone to great lengths to keep his surveillance of American Jews a secret, particularly from the Kennedy administration. Attorney General Bobby Kennedy made almost no effort to hide his desire to force Hoover out, and rumors spread that a Jew might actually step into his august shoes. Hoover and many in the upper echelons of the Bureau were absolutely outraged, and before long, an ultimately successful campaign was underway to save the master wiretapper of U.S. intelligence. The electronic surveillance of Jews picked up during the Nixon administration but quieted down a bit after Watergate. In 1978, Congress finally passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance, or FIS, Act, a feeble attempt to stamp out some of the worst excesses of domestic espionage. Parenthetically, it is this act that the Bush administration is perceived as violating. In fact, basically, it never really took effect. Continuing. In another bit of lawyerly leisure domain, the FIS Act was restricted only to targeting by American agencies, leaving the British liaison officer with a major loophole. The restrictive language added to the FIS Act left unchanged the arrangement under which the British wiretapped American suspects and then passed on the information to the NSA. Inman, it should be noted, was not in the NSA during 1975-6 when the language of the British loophole was contrived, although he was its director in 1978 when the act finally became law. To this day, Congress does not realize that the British liaison officers at the NSA are still free to use American equipment to spy on American citizens. And in fact, they are doing just that. Congress has been kept in the dark deliberately. This is a fact, not a matter of conjecture or a conclusion based on anonymous sources. In the early 1980s, during the Reagan administration, one of the authors of this book submitted to the intelligence community a draft of a manuscript that briefly described the wiretap shell game and mentioned that the secrecy provisions concerning British liaison relationships with the NSA have escaped congressional knowledge. The result was an uproar. The intelligence community insisted that all passages explaining the British wiretap program had to be censored and provided a list of specific deletions. Even the simple mention of the existence of a secret agreement of which Congress was unaware was banned as classified information. In 1985, when the author was called to testify about Nazis working for U.S. intelligence before a congressional subcommittee, he asked permission to discuss certain items pertaining to electronic surveillance in executive session. Permission was denied. So much for congressional oversight. Shortly after the Clinton administration took office, the intelligence community withdrew its previous objections to publication. In fact, many of the pieces of the jigsaw already had passed into the public domain. In 1982, James Bamford published his seminal history of the NSA, The Puzzle Palace, which disclosed some of the main points of the NSA-GCHQ liaison. The National Archives had been given dozens of declassified government documents citing British intelligence as the source of its information on Jews in the United States. And finally, in 1991, a pair of British authors confirmed a portion of the espionage on American Jews. Quote, "Sometime in 1945 or 1946, a special unit, even more secret than the rest of the code-breaking agency, was set up to monitor the activities of Israeli agents and their sympathizers in the U.S. and elsewhere. The men who ran this organization held the view that because of the use made by the Israelis of sympathizers from the Jewish community, no Jew, however apparently loyal a U.S. citizen, should be permitted to work in the special unit or even be told of its existence. All reports from the unit carried the code name Gold, signifying that they were not to be shown to anyone of Jewish origin. We had them cold," unquote, recalls one former intelligence official who was cleared to see the Gold reports. Again, quoting, "We knew who was shipping the arms, who was paying for them, who was being paid in this country, every illegal thing that was going on in this country. Because of politics, very little was ever done with this intelligence, but so far as I know, the National Security Agency still has a group like that buried somewhere deep," unquote. And Loftus and Ahrens go on to comment, "It does indeed. Its nickname is the Jew Room," unquote. "Inside the National Security Agency is an intelligence center from which all American Jews are banned, regardless of their proven loyalty or devotion to country, just as the U.S. Navy banned Jews from electronic surveillance ships such as the USS Liberty. The Jew Room is where the United States and Britain spy on Israel and anyone who supports Israel. Its name is a misnomer, as the intelligence center has more than one room in more than one agency. As we shall see in the following chapters, it is and has been the heart of the secret war against the Jews." And later on, Loftus and Ahrens go on to note that the program became so ridiculous that Jewish children who were going to Jewish summer camps are actually the focal point of some of the intelligence collection. All of which is to say that warrantless wiretapping and things which are technically unconstitutional have been a matter of routine, and they have been from the get-go. So why are we seeing this flap? Well, that's because there are elements of the intelligence community that are deliberately leaking information in order to fight back against the Bush administration for its abuse of the intelligence community. We're going to take a quick look at a few of those leaks right now. The L.A. Times, from Wednesday, January 4th of 2006, has an article by Josh Meyer, Dateline Washington, headlined, CIA gave Iran bomb plans, book says. Subtitled, the nuclear designs were intentionally flawed, but Tehran was tipped off and could have made use of them, the writer contends. It reads in part, and by the way, you're going to see reference here again to the book that Edward Alden made reference to in the first column that we read, namely the James Risen book, State of War. This article reads in part, in a clumsy effort to sabotage Iran's nuclear program, the CIA in 2004 intentionally handed Tehran some top-secret bomb designs laced with a hidden flaw that U.S. officials hoped would doom any weapons made from them, according to a new book about the U.S. intelligence agency. But the Iranians were tipped to the scheme by the Russian defector hired by the CIA to deliver the plans and may have gleaned scientific information useful for designing a bomb, writes New York Times reporter James Risen in State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration, unquote. The clandestine CIA effort was just one of many alleged intelligence failures during the Bush administration, according to the book. Risen also cites intelligence gaffes that fueled the Bush administration's case for war against Saddam Hussein, spawning a culture of torture throughout the U.S. military and encouraged the rise of heroin cultivation and trafficking in post-war Afghanistan. Even before the book's release Tuesday, its main revelation that President Bush authorized a secret effort by another intelligence outfit, the National Security Agency, to eavesdrop on unsuspecting Americans without court-approved warrants, had created a storm of controversy when it was reported last month in the New York Times in an article co-authored by Risen. Well, again, this stuff has been going on since the day one. So, again, why the sudden outrage? That's because these leaks are part of something that really approximates a civil war within the intelligence community. Skipping down. According to the book, the CIA effort to sabotage Iran's nuclear effort came on the heels of another massive intelligence failure in which a CIA officer mistakenly sent an Iranian agent a trove of information that could help identify nearly every one of the spy agency's undercover operatives in Iran. The Iranian was a double agent who turned over the data to Iranian authorities. They used it to dismantle the CIA's spy network inside the country and arrest or possibly kill an unknown number of U.S. agents, the book says. So again, the new James Risen book filled with information about missteps by the Bush administration, these leaks apparently being done to deliberately undermine the Bush against something of a civil war. Yet another leak coming from the intelligence community. New York Times, February 11, 2006. Article by Scott Shane, Dateline Washington, headlined, Ex-CIA official says Iraq data was distorted. One of a number of disclosures about the fudging of intelligence. This article reads in part, a CIA veteran who oversaw intelligence assessments about the Middle East from 2000 to 2005 on Friday accused the Bush administration of ignoring or distorting the pre-war evidence on a broad range of issues related to Iraq in its effort to justify the American invasion of 2003. The views of Paul R. Pillar, who retired in October as National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia, echoed previous criticism from Democrats and from some administration officials, including Richard A. Clark, the former White House counterterrorism advisor, and Paul H. O'Neill, a former Treasury Secretary. But Mr. Pillar is the first high-level CIA insider to speak out by name on the use of pre-war intelligence. His article for the March-April issue of Foreign Affairs, which charges the administration with the selective use of intelligence about Iraq's unconventional weapons and the chances of post-war chaos in Iraq, was posted Friday on the journal's website after it was first reported in the American Post. As the Downing Street memo indicates, there are elements within the British National Security Establishment that are also conducting a deliberate leaking campaign, so to speak, sort of turning this into sort of an Anglo-Saxon national security civil war. Article from the Los Angeles Times from February 11th of 2006, a new book out in Britain supplements the Downing Street memo. This article is titled Book Casts Doubt on Case for War. It's by John Danisewski of the LA Times. Again, dated February 11th of 06, Dateline London. It reads in part, "It was the end of January of 2003. Secretary of State Colin Powell was 5 days away from giving a critical speech at the UN Security Council, laying out the case that Iraq was hiding weapons of mass destruction and posed a danger to world peace. But huddled with aides at the White House, President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair were not sure there was enough evidence to convince the Security Council. Without the Council's explicit authorization, their plans for an invasion to depose Saddam Hussein could be difficult to defend under international law. Bush proposed an alternative. Paint a U.S. spy plane in United Nations colors and see if that didn't tempt Hussein's forces to shoot at it. In any case, he said, the war was penciled in, unquote, for March 10th, and the United States would go ahead with or without a second U.N. resolution. Blair replied that he was solidly with, unquote, the president. This is the gist of an account of the January 31st, 2003 meeting contained in the new edition of Lawless World, a book by British author Philippe Sands. He has not identified the writer of the memorandum on which the account is based, but British media reports say it was one of the aides in attendance, Sir David Manning, then security advisor to Blair and now the British ambassador in Washington. So again, in addition to the Downing Street memo, that leak coming out as well. Yet another intelligence leak, creating a very accurately unflattering picture of the Bush administration's conduct of this particular war. An article from the Financial Times of Wednesday, January 4th of 2006. This is an article by Peter Spiegel. It's headlined, Ex-CIA Agent Says U.S. Missed Bin Laden in Afghan Battle. This article reads in part of yet, and this, by the way, talks about yet another intelligence failure, the escape of Bin Laden from Tora Bora. It reads in part, U.S. military commanders were told that Osama bin Laden was hiding in the mountainous Tora Bora region of Afghanistan in early December of 2001, but failed to send troops to block his escape, according to a new account by the CIA officer who ran the agency's operations in the country. Gary Burnson, a CIA veteran who headed a paramilitary team called Jawbreaker during the Afghan War, said in a book published last week that one of his Arab-speaking operatives found a radio on a dead al-Qaeda fighter during the Tora Bora battle and heard the terrorist leader repeatedly trying to rally his troops. Quote, after the Spectre gunship aircraft cleared the area, Bilal heard a voice he recognized from dozens of tape recordings, Mr. Burnson wrote, using a pseudonym for an Arab-American former Marine who was part of the CIA team. Quote, it was Osama bin Laden telling his troops to keep fighting, unquote. Later on the same captured radio, Bilal and a second CIA agent, another American of Middle Eastern origin, reported hearing Mr. bin Laden apologizing for getting his men trapped in the mountains and killed in large numbers by American bombing, Mr. Burnson wrote. The book titled Jawbreaker was heavily edited by CIA censors. Note that this part did make it out from the editorial process, almost certainly once again an attempt at embarrassing the Bush administration. Mr. Burnson also wrote that on the recommendation of a former Special Forces officer who was part of his team as a CIA contractor, he made a formal request to have 800 U.S. Army Rangers deployed along the Pakistani border to prevent Mr. bin Laden's escape, a request that was never granted. The issue of whether U.S. commanders failed to capture Mr. bin Laden at Tora Bora because of an over-reliance on unreliable Afghan warlords became an issue in the 2004 presidential campaign when Democratic challenger John Kerry accused the Bush administration of allowing the al-Qaeda leader to escape by not sending American troops to the battlefield. At the time, retired General Tommy Franks, the former head of U.S. Central Command who ran the Afghan campaign, denied that the military knew of Mr. bin Laden's presence and accused Mr. Kerry of relying on, quote, distortions of history, unquote. Well, apparently that was not the case. Now, another key factor vis-a-vis the wiretap scandal, and that concerns the fact that none other than Grover Norquist, arguably the linchpin of the GOP right, has suddenly become terribly concerned with civil liberties, and he has joined with what is, to a certain extent at least, a liberal coalition in order to inveigh against this warrantless wiretapping. San Francisco Chronicle, Thursday, January 26th of 2006. Article by James Sterngold. It's headlined, Political Opposites Aligned Against Bush Wiretaps. And this concerns Grover Norquist. Grover Norquist is one of the most influential conservative Republicans in Washington. His weekly Wednesday meeting at his L Street office is a must for conservative strategists, and he has been called the managing director of the hardcore right by the Liberal Nation magazine. Perhaps the nation's leading anti-tax enthusiast, he is, like Diamond, a hawk in the war on terror. Yes, he is a hawk on the war on terror, but as we have seen in many broadcasts, Grover Norquist is in fact the lobbyist for some of the most heinous terrorists and terror-linked elements in the country. His Islamic Institute, part of the GOP's ethnic outreach organization, was basically a repository for al-Taqwa, Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and al-Qaeda-related elements, and Norquist was the personal lobbyist for many of these people. In a number of broadcasts that will be cited in the description, for the record, 541, some of Norquist's heinous representation of the very terrorists the Bush administration professes to be against will be discussed at some length. And by the way, the Norquist cloud has not been raised from the national security establishment. Again, I think that Norquist's concern, as he says, he's worried that Hillary Clinton or somebody like her could eventually come into this information. If the truth were ever to fully be disclosed, it would reveal that Grover Norquist and his ilk are in fact running interference for the very terrorists that are our enemy in this war, something that it has unfortunately escaped a lot of people's notice. But the Norquist name is still very much part of the struggle. Following article with which we'll close the program comes from Salon.com. Guess who the new chief financial officer is for the Department of Homeland Security? It's Grover Norquist's kid brother, David Norquist. This article by Tim Grieve, the best person he could find? We don't have any doubt that George Bush will pick the best person, unquote, he can find to serve as the new chief financial officer for the Department of Homeland Security. And if that best person just happens to be the brother of an informal advisor to the president who has been implicated in the Jack Abramoff scandal, well, life is full of funny coincidences. With the tip of the war room helmet to Josh Marshall, we note word that the president plans to name David L. Norquist as the new CFO for DHS. As UPI reports, Norquist is the younger brother of Grover Norquist, the anti-tax crusader who would like to see the federal government shrunk down so small you could drown it in a bathtub just as soon as he and Abramoff are done profiting from it. Well, again, I suspect that Grover Norquist's concern over wiretapping concerns some of the things that he must have been saying to his numerous terrorist clients, because Grover Norquist, the Islamic Institute, and people like Sami Alarian, Abdurrahman Alamoudi, and others constitute the direct link between the GOP and its ethnic outreach organization and some of the most heinous terrorists that, in theory at least, the Bush administration is supposed to be fighting. But we can all rest easy knowing that Grover Norquist's kid brother is going to be managing the finances for the Department of Homeland Security. Whew, that is a relief. Please do take advantage of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com and the many, many linked websites, a vast treasure trove of written material. And again, within a couple of weeks of the airing of this broadcast, there will be a long article-length written description of For the Record Program 541. Do take advantage of the Spitfire website and linked websites, a vast and growing amount of both printed and audio information to supplement these broadcasts. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program number 541, titled Leaks, being recorded on February 12th of the year 2006. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.